You are listening to Been There, Done That. We present some of the smartest people connected to the business of coffee. People who've succeeded in the tough grind of hospitality by staying ahead of the rest. So join us as we explore the secrets to their success and help you accelerate your business. This show is brought to you by the Coffee Commune, where the coffee community comes to collaborate. Enjoy the show.
Hi, Phil DiBella here from the Coffee Commune, and you're listening to another episode of Been There and Done That, where we bring in industry experts so that we can help accelerate your potential. And now we've moved into our business performance quarter, so it's all about helping you perform better in your business. And today I've got the great pleasure of having a regular guest that we have as one of the mindsets and brain trusts of the Coffee Commune community. I welcome Craig Hong from Hill House Lawyers. Craig, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me, Phil.
Oh, mate, it's always a pleasure. You've always got so much wisdom to share. And Craig's the Corporate and Commercial Director at Hill House Lawyers, a great part of the coffee community, and they do lots of stuff with our community here and helping people accelerate their potential. Today, what I want to talk about, Craig, in terms of business performance, which is the quarter we're now delving in here at the Commune as a theme, I want to cover selling cafes. I want to cover a little bit about equity sharing, risk, and a little bit about franchising. And if we've got some time, we might even tick off leases. But you've done a segment on leases before. But the big one for me to kick off is, you know, there's a lot of cafes, businesses at the moment who are looking at selling. Some businesses are sellable. Some are probably not sellable. Talk us through what, from your experience right now, what strategies should they have in place before they actually make that step to go to market? So somebody that's out there listening saying, I want to sell my cafe, what are the first go-to steps that they need to do?
Okay, well, look, when you're talking about selling your business, I guess the most important thing is people can't buy what's up in your head. They need to actually be able to buy things that they can touch, see, feel. And so really it's about getting whatever is in your head or what's good about the business down on paper. It's about getting it into your accounts. So having the business accounts totally separate and clean. You don't want it sort of mixed up with all of your personal accounts.
So it's separate really, your personal and your business.
Separate your personal and your business. And really, I try to encourage businesses to actually run their business like they could sell it at any time.
Yeah, so, good advice.
Because I guess a couple of things come out of that. If you're always looking as though someone's going to buy your business, you'll be running it with an eye to improving it, making it good for someone coming in looking from the outside. So it really is about that, just getting it clean, ready, written down, you know, contracts, everything needs to be in place so that a buyer can see what's going on.
Yeah, key one there for me is run, you know, in terms of business performance, run your business every day as if you want to sell it so that you keep improving. And in terms of legals, because you made a great point there, a lot of people start as a, you know, sole operator or small business, and some of them grow and we mix in personal with, you know, business. And so that was another good point, is separate your business and your personal stuff on market. Now, legally, what about registrations of business names and all that sort of stuff? What are the checklists there before you go to market?
Yeah, so things like IP. So, you know, if you've got a great brand, you want to get a trademark, business names themselves. So depending on how you're set up, so sometimes the company name will be the business name. Sometimes you will have a separate business name, so you've got to go out and register that with the business names register. You also want, obviously, all of your key contracts in place in writing. You know, you might have a great handshake deal, but a buyer can't rely on that.
Yeah, so
they need to see that down in writing. And if you have a great relationship with someone, putting it down in writing won't be a problem.
Secure those things that make your business unique. So if you've got unique agreements with suppliers, make sure that you cement them in writing. That's a really, really good point.
Yeah, exactly.
Something that often people don't think about. Because just because you're getting a great deal doesn't mean that the supplier is going to give the next person a great deal. And I want to segue into this, which to me is what people are actually buying. There's two values to a business, right? There's the operational value and what it's doing in terms of its numbers, its profit or potential for profit and growth and that. But then there's another one that a lot of people haven't spoken about and don't speak about these days, which is very important, is goodwill. And so if you secure everything that you say, is that you're actually securing parts of the goodwill, which is what people are buying into your business.
Yeah, exactly. There is that element that goes over and above, you know, what is there on the paper. But there are ways to really secure that, you know, like good record keeping. You know, quite often with employees, we'll see people that only write down the bad stuff. So when they have a performance management meeting or whatever, they'll keep records. They should be keeping records of all the good stuff that goes on with employees as well. So when someone's looking through the records of the business, they can see, hey, such and such employee is a great person. I want to keep that person around. They're a real value add to the business.
It's a great point, because you're not only buying what's solid about the business, but you're buying what the potential is in the business as well. So once you're ready for sale, in terms of contracts, what's the next step? So you're ready for sale, you've separated everything out, you've put down all your valuable assets, not just physical assets, but your goodwill assets and what's good about the business. What are the next steps once you obviously embark the sale process? You've got somebody to look after, to sell your business. You found a buyer. Let's talk through the contract part of that.
Okay. So the next step is obviously going to contract. So usually what we would see is that there would be a term sheet which sets out, I guess, the broad brush details of the deal. It'll have sort of your key timeframes, what the price is going to be, if there's any due diligence before contract or post contract, because there are, you know, two different times you can do those things, and any of the key conditions. So, you know, if someone needs a deal to be subject to finance, they'll write that down then and there. Yeah. And then what will happen is once that term sheet gets, I guess, knocked into a form that everyone's happy with, we'd then proceed to the more formal contracts. Yeah.
So the key is to make sure that term sheet has all your wish list on it and their wish list, obviously, and then you've got to obviously start negotiating backwards is something that I say. Is when I sold DiBella Coffee, you know, BDO were great and it said, right, write down everything that your wish list is and what the terms are, obviously what your price looks like, your exit time, so settlement, any sort of other ways. You might be taking some shares, you might not be taking shares, yep. You might be remaining some equity or not. But then there's also things like your ongoing employment that people forget about. Are you required to stay for you know, a year later or 6 months later or 2 weeks, restraint of trades.
Yep.
So what other key elements are they got to be careful and that needs to go on that term sheet?
So probably the main things are, yeah, as you say, price, times, any key conditions, the restraints, things like, so if there are particular assets that have to come across, so sometimes obviously your remaining employment might be a key component, but it also might be you might have other key people that they say, we want to know that person X or Y stays on with the business as well, because they'll want to tie up that person that they might see as their future manager.
Part of the goodwill.
Yeah, exactly. And then if there are other conditions that kind of inform risk going forward, so things like warranties, or if there's like an earn out where, you know, the business has to hit some certain performance milestones. Yeah.
And so that's why the importance, if you're listening to this and you're thinking of selling or you're in the process, you need to make sure that you have a good lawyer on board. Of course, we recommend Hill House Lawyers, but there's make sure that you've got a good lawyer that has done this many times and it's not their first rodeo, yeah. Because there'll be certain things that you don't want to miss. And then make sure that you've got a good financial advice organization. And we obviously work closely with BDO. They've done my sale. I know Hill House works closely with BDO. So let's talk through the importance of not just having a very good lawyer, but having a very good, you know, finance person behind you. And I don't like the word accountant, because accountant is one set of skills. I always say, you know, you want a strategic finance person during a sale working alongside a lawyer.
Oh, yeah. They really are hand in glove. I think 90% of the time when we have a big deal, we try to have a meeting jointly with all of the key stakeholders, so the financial advisors, accountants, and us. We'll sit in the room with the client and make sure that everyone's kind of singing from the same hymn sheet, because it all is so critical and you're wasting time and money, I guess, by doing all of these things. Yeah. Separately.
And from experience, the importance of what Craig's saying, listeners, is that depending on how you are structured and set up and what your financial position in terms of other assets and all the rest of it are, there is ways that you can reduce your tax liabilities. And that's why the importance that, you know, as Craig's saying, he needs to be in the room with your accountant or your strategic financial advisors so that they can maximize the best deal for you. And it doesn't matter how big or small the transaction is, which is another question for you. You know, I get asked all the time, am I too small to talk to Hill House, or am I too small to be working with BDO? Let's talk about the misconceptions of that.
Yeah, I think generally you'll find that we're business people ourselves and we understand the realities of different sizes of business. And look, there is a certain threshold of things that need to be done to properly transact a business and to protect your interests. But we're conscious of those issues and really you're way better off getting good, proper advice, no matter what the purchase price is, because it's going to alleviate a lot of risk. Quite often, if you get that good accounting advice, you can save any cost that you spend on lawyers and accountants. Yeah, they're in one little saving on their tax.
You know? Good point. And that's something that, listeners, you've got to be aware of it. Again, this is from experience, is that, you know, a lawyer might cost you, let's pick a number, $10,000 for a job, and you might think that's expensive, but there's a good chance if you go and spend $2,000 instead of the $10,000 that it could cost you $20,000 at the end, versus spending $10,000 up front saves you $10,000. And same with accountants. I mean, you know, I'll give you an example. Last year in my personal tax return, what I spent with BDO, they actually found one way to structure our business that saved us double what they cost me for the year. Now, had I not been using a high level accounting firm or strategic financial firm, they probably wouldn't have found that. So, you know, there's two ways to look at things. You know, spend a dollar now and save two later, or think you're saving two now and it costs you four later. So just keep that in the back of your mind. You need good professional people around you that know what they're doing. Craig, what are the pitfalls? What are some of the things that can go horribly wrong in a sale contract, and therefore how do we avoid them?
Yeah, probably the main ones is, I guess, in that term sheet, if you've got different expectations to the buyer and you haven't kind of gotten to the same place with each other, that's where the risk is already increased. And then if the contract is poorly drafted, that's going to magnify that risk. And so that usually will come out in either you can't get to settlement properly because you can't provide something that the buyer's expecting, or you might have a situation where there's a warranty claim, which is obviously the buyer is dissatisfied and is seeking some or all of their money back from the purchase. And that's a really bad spot to be in, because, you know, you'll be in a spot where you don't have the business anymore, and they're coming back to you to get some of the purchase price back. So it's the worst of all worlds.
So you need to make sure your term sheet's right. You need to make sure you're agreeing on it. And then when you go to contract, you need to make sure your contract's drafted right.
Yep.
So obviously the errors you're seeing is a lot of contracts get drafted poorly and it ends up hurting the party.
Yeah. And there's probably a bit of an assumption too that if something's sort of a standard form contract, that it's all going to be fine, but that you really still need to take time to understand what it is you are warranting or promising to the buyer, because if you do get that warranty claim, it could be a whole heap of your purchase money back in their pocket.
Yeah. So good advice there on selling a cafe, as Craig has pointed out. Make sure you're separating your personal and your business stuff. Make sure you're getting all your assets down on paper, not just your physical assets, but your goodwill assets and what's good in terms of your people and your business and what's unique. Make sure you're trademarking anything that's unique. You've got your supplier agreements bedded down, and then you're ready to go to put your business up. But make sure your term sheet is perfect. Everybody's happy with the term sheet. If the work's I always say, if you do the hard work now, it becomes easier later. Get that term sheet right and the contract in good form using good professional people, and that mitigates a lot of your risk. Let's move on to, you don't want to sell your business, but you want to take, say, some money off the table and you want to share the burden. And a great way to do that is obviously with equity sharing or profit sharing.
Yep.
Let's talk the opportunities there. So what do you suggest to somebody that says, no, you know, I don't really want to sell, but I do want to take some money off the table and I want to share the workload, or both? How do they go about this, Craig?
Well, look, one of the best ways to have people invested in your business is to have people literally invested in your business. So there's all sorts of ways to do it. And generally it will be with your key employees is one of the places that you start. Mm. For instance, myself, I came into ownership of Hill House through the older guys at the firm sort of brought me through for a little bit at the start. Yes. And then as they were winding down their career, they took, look, it was probably a 10-year plan where my holding slowly increased as they wound down.
Yeah. So, and now you're a shareholder.
And now I'm a full director, but yeah. It took time to get there. But I was very invested because I'd put some of my own skin in the game. I had money on the table. And also I wanted to see my investment grow and mature as those guys were kind of winding down. I was gearing up.
Yeah. So. And that's a good point that Craig makes there, is that you don't just wake up one day and go, I'm going to do equity share. You should be actually building some aspiration. If you've got people, my model is, if you've got people in your business good enough to own their own business, you've got to give them a reason not to. So the first point you made is skin in the game. So identify the people that are good enough to own their own business, but you want to keep them. And communicate with them, give them that aspiration, as obviously Hill House has done with you, Craig, is give them the pathway of what it looks like. And it might not happen today, it might not happen in 6 months, it might be 2 years. In your case, it was a 10-year process. So some good points you make there. Now, right, I've identified the person, I've spoken with them, it's time to give them shares. How do we go about it?
Okay, so, well, look, there's a few ways you can do it because depending on your structure, so you will be governed by whatever.
Well, most people are companies.
Your structure is, yeah. So if you're a company, you do have some flexibility because companies can issue different classes of shares. So you don't have to go to full ownership straight away. If someone, you know, for instance, if you've got an employee that doesn't have a lot of capital ready to go, you might be giving them a special class of share that's just an interest in the profits, and it might be a small interest to start with.
So what sort of class share would that be?
So it might be an A class, an B A class, class okay. share, and they might not get a vote, so they may not have a say.
So there's
say.
No vote, there's no, yeah, because you haven't put, say, physical capital in.
Yep.
You don't have a seat at the table, or so to speak, in decision-making, but you certainly get a share of the profits.
Yep.
And it's all documented and legal, right?
Yeah, exactly. And it's sitting there on, so usually the share class rights themselves will be down in the constitution or a shareholders agreement that sets out what the rights are attaching to that share. And then hopefully if you sit down and have that discussion, you say, well, you know, you can use the money that you get from this share, put that away, and then we can start talking about whether
equity share.
Buying some proper equity shares.
Yeah. So there's a good point there. You don't have to be – equity sharing is not just physical equity sharing. It's also you can have non-equity shares in a business. So that's a great point there. So if you're thinking you've got a cafe, it's going well, but you want to take some money off the table, or you want to share the workload in this case, then you can step it. You can do non-voting shares and give people a share of the profit with perhaps no equity or a holding equity somewhere, which a lot of firms do. You put money in a bank account, it sits there, and if you ever pull out, you get it back.
Yeah.
But there's also obviously equity sharing, which is you sell, you get the business valued, and you sell at 10% or 15% or 5% of it. What are the things to make sure that you get right when you're doing this?
So I guess when you do bring another person in, that is another personality, and there's just like with the term sheet on selling the business, you're bringing in someone, so you need to make sure that your expectations all align. So if someone just thinks that this extra share is just a little bit more money, if it's effectively a pay rise for them, they might not be as invested as someone who sees that roadmap to full equity down the track.
Yeah.
So it's really important that you do a shareholders agreement now, because you're going to have these new personalities in your business. So you make sure that everyone is got the same expectations about how you're going to run it from here on out.
Good point. So as important as the term sheet is, now we're getting into, and we're going to explore it a little bit further, the shareholders agreement. And from experience again, the shareholders agreement is a little bit like a prenuptials or a terms of what happens if you get divorced with your partner. Is you don't want to be having that discussion when there's a problem. You want to be having that discussion at the beginning when everything's perfect. So shareholders agreement for me, and I'll hand over to you in a minute, is get it right up front. When every party is willing and excited and all the feel-good emotions are flying around the place about becoming a shareholder, get the shareholders agreement set and get the do's and the don'ts. And more importantly, this is from experience, is make sure that the shareholders agreement covers not just the good times, but what happens if something goes wrong. Let's hand over to you. You're the expert in the room.
Yeah, 100%. So I think one of the problems we do see when people are doing this process, the shareholders agreement, is they just do assume that everyone is going to be on the same page. Now, the reality is with a good shareholders agreement, you won't need to look at it unless there's a problem. So you have to have that eye on, I guess, both the good times and the bad times. You have to be in the back of your mind thinking,
yep,
where are we going to be if this doesn't work? And so, as you say, when everyone's keen to go, everyone has, you know, rose-colored glasses on. And so quite often they'll ask for a clause that says, well, if someone wants to leave, the price will be what we agree at the time. Now, as you know, if things aren't going well,
that's right,
your chances of actually agreeing at that point in time is very close to zero. So you've got to include some actual hard mechanisms in there. So, you know, same thing as with the business sale, we'll be talking to the accountants in conjunction, and we might say, well, look, the price will be as we agree, but if we can't agree, what we're going to do is we're going to go off to BDO and we're going to get them to perform a valuation and tell us what the price is. So you just have some sort of a circuit breaker.
Really map out that shareholders agreement.
Yep.
I mean, again, I went through it with when we was sorting out New York. My shareholders agreement was prepared between BDO and Hill House. It was right on the money. It was perfect. So that anytime it got a little bit missy because there was three different shareholders, we just reverted back to the shareholders agreement and it sorted itself out very, very quickly. It takes all the emotion off the table. So I can't stress the importance of it firsthand. This is not just Craig as a lawyer saying you need it because, hey, we charge you. No, that's bullshit. You need it because it is a vital document and alleviates risk if you get that shareholders right. And again, the misconception is great. Doesn't matter what size your business is, right? It can be a cafe turning over $10,000 a week with a shareholder. Doesn't matter what size your business is. You need these documents in place.
Oh yeah, 100%. And it's another one of those sort of penny wise and pound foolish things that if you do get into a shareholders dispute, the dollars that you're going to spend and the damage that is done to your business is going to be 10, 15, 20, 100 times the value that you spend on the shareholders agreement. Because, you know, if you're in a dispute, if you're in court, you can blow through, you know,
$10,000
to $100,000 very fast. Whereas, you know, a shareholders agreement, you know, for most businesses, small, you know, you're talking a couple of $1,000s, yeah, which can save you tens to hundreds.
Oh, it's a cheap. And not only that, think about the opportunity cost, the distraction away from the business that, you know, especially cafes, they're hard work. You've got to be present. You've got to be on the ball. You know, there's small transactions and multiple transactions. You know, you get distracted from that and your business suffers, not just, you know, in terms of what it costs you. It costs you also in your revenue and your clientele. So risk, very generally, you hear the theme, get comfortable with your worst case scenario. And the best way to get comfortable with your worst case scenario is to have the right documents in place that help you do that. So it takes the emotion off the table and makes sure that you're secured. The last thing I want to touch on, Craig, is franchising. So obviously, they're the three common things that normally happen if everything's going well. Unfortunately, there's a lot of businesses closing. Pre-COVID, there was 19,000 cafes in Australia, Craig. There's now 26,500 cafes in Australia, which is a bit of a scary statistic because it is. And we're very oversupplied and under demand because the population certainly hasn't gone up relative to support that business. So unfortunately, you're going to see a lot of cafes closing, and they are closing. But, you know, this segment's all about selling your cafe or selling or bringing a partner on equity-wise. Or the last part is you're really booming or you've got something unique. And we've got a few clients in our community here doing this, franchising or licensing. So what I want to touch on is the opportunities that you want to multiply your store, but you don't want to own them. Let's talk through the best ways of that and the difference between franchising and licensing.
Okay. So look, I guess franchising and licensing is basically you have a great product or a great system and you want to get it out and let other people use that. And usually what will happen is they will pay you some sort of a fee for that, be it a franchise fee or a license fee. And, you know, there's a whole heap of ways to achieve that. But that's, I guess, the base proposition is that someone is going to use your systems, your products, whatever it is that you've got, and they're going to pay you some compensation for that. So it is a great way to grow because you don't have to necessarily be involved 100% in the business. You just are involved in delivering that great system, that great product. So it is a great way to expand without physical presence of yourself.
And what sort of documents do you require? So what sort of legal, because it does require legal setup.
So yeah, look, I guess the downside with franchising is that it does come with an extra layer of compliance. So you do have to do a whole heap of things to comply with the franchising code of conduct. So it's going to mean disclosure statements before someone enters into the relationship, and you are bound to a number of, I guess, minimum standards that you're going to have to adhere to. So it can be a bit more expensive, but look, once you get it rolling, I guess the other side of the coin is that you are making that sort of more passive money where there's money coming in from the franchising fees or the purchase of your products that you couldn't achieve yourself because you just can't be in a million places at once. So,
The keys, obviously, to franchising, having obviously lots of experience in this area, having sold my DiBella coffee business to Retail Food Group, is three reasons people franchise is you do have something unique or different to offer. They want the training and support, you know, including marketing. So marketing, training, support. And the third one is that they want the buying power. So obviously the buying power of, say, 10 stores or 20 stores or 100 stores is going to be greater than the buying power of one. So a good franchise system, obviously, obviously discloses all that in its documents and makes very clear what they're going to get for in return for their franchise fees, right?
Yeah, and look, I guess from the perspective of the purchase coming into the franchise, they probably have a lot more confidence than they are just diving in themselves, because there is a system behind them, there is size behind them, so they're not just, I guess, taking it all on by themselves. They feel like they've got someone supporting them. So that can be very valuable to a lot of people, because they want to come into something that has a bit of ready-made, you know, yeah. As you say, the marketing, they have a bit of market share immediately because of the name. So yeah.
So if you're both sides of the ledger, obviously if you're one looking to franchise, make sure you have something unique, make sure that you do have good systems in place to provide buying power, and make sure that you do have a program in place to help with training and marketing, because they're the pitfalls of franchises that fall over, is that they don't do that. And if, on the flip side, if you're looking to buy into a franchise and become a franchisee, then they're the three solid things you want. You want to be buying into a system that obviously does have something unique or different, or fast tracks your business ownership. It does provide the ongoing training and marketing, and it does give you solid buying power and benefits for being part of a big group. The pitfalls, what are the biggest things you see when someone's coming to Hill House, unfortunately, for litigation in franchise space? What's gone wrong?
So probably in franchising, the thing to understand is that there are trade-offs. So if you're buying into a franchise, you probably need, just like with a lease of a premise, you probably need to know how long you're there for and what does it cost me to go again. So you might have a 5-year term or a 10-year term. So what happens after that 10 years? How do I extract value, or how do I keep being able to continue on with that franchise? Do I have to pay another franchise fee? Is there a renewal? So because it is kind of a partnership, you are in with this franchisor. So what are they going to give you down the track to let you keep going? Or is there a big cost again? Do you have to effectively buy your own business back?
So, yeah, and things like refit out clauses, like how often do you need to refit if they go and change the brand? So there's all these little things, and that's why you need good people in your corner. Keep coming back to making sure that you have good people around you that can help advise, because you're technically not going to be the expert. You know, somebody that's got a great business idea that's sitting there listening to this going, I've got a great business in play now. I want to multiply it out. I've got something unique. I can do the buying power and the training, da-da-da. That's what you're an expert in. You're not expert in legals, and you're not an expert in finance. So make sure you're choosing the right team around you to safeguard and come back to risk, is mitigate that risk so that you're in the you're comfortable with the worst case scenario always.
Yep.
So let's talk through the last part of franchising I wanted to cover, is the different ways that people can collect fees, because they don't know. I get asked this all the time. If I set up a franchise, do I charge 10%? Do I take 7%? So again, let's talk through the different ways that you can obviously franchise fees or license fees, because some people just take a flat fee. Talk through the two differences from your perspective.
So there's a whole heap of things that you can do. So some franchises will have an upfront franchise fee to literally open a location. You may be paying a fee to the franchisor to then
lump sum
the business. Some will take a license fee that's ongoing, so they might take some percentage of your earnings. Some may make the bulk of their money off the products that you
no
use.
Fee.
Yeah, so there may be very low fees to start with, but there may be that you have to use a particular type of coffee. You have to sell our hamburgers, and they're selling you the ingredients that go into the products. So there are a wide variety of ways to do it, and quite often they will be a combination of those things. You know, I know McDonald's made a lot of money off literally being a landlord. So they went out and secured a whole heap of good real estate, and then so the franchisees who are there for a long time actually become really great tenants.
Great tenants, and that's how they make the bulk of their money.
So,
it's good, and you've covered a fair bit of it. The key there is to make sure it's sustainable. Whatever model you're looking at franchising, and again, why you've got to have good people around you, is that you've got to be a model that's sustainable. And I'll give you an example right now in cafes. There is not 10%. You know, margins for a cafe owner. So if you've got a cafe right now and you say, I'm going to franchise, it used to be roughly, say, anywhere between 7 and 12%, you know, franchise fee. Unless you're going to save that money somewhere else, whether it's in the cost of goods or the wages because you've got a unique system or process, there is not going to be 10% to give out of your cafe after you pay 35, 40% wages, 25% cost of goods, 10% GST. You're just running out of percentages, right? And that's why the importance, and it doesn't matter whether you're looking to franchise or you're looking at buying a franchise, the numbers have got to stack up. the financial model has to work, you know, as to the points that Craig made. Do you charge no license fee or franchise fee ongoing because you're going to make some money from selling them coffee or bread or butter or whatever it is? Or do you charge a little bit of a franchise fee and a little bit of a margin on the products? But the point that comes back from over 34 years of myself experience in cafes and hospitality is the numbers need to stack and you need to know your numbers. So maybe reverse engineer it and then sit down with your lawyer, someone like Craig, and go, right, how can I structure this so that it works for me, but it works for the franchisee?
Yeah, it's got to be a good deal for both sides, because if you have something that's going to put too much pressure on franchisees, what'll happen is some of them will fall over, and then the ones that you have that haven't fallen over will start getting nervous and you get a bit of a snowball effect. So it's really got to be a good deal for both sides.
Again, you see the theme. It's all in the preparation. Unfortunately, and this is one of the mindsets and one of the finishing questions for you, Craig, is I've always seen lawyers, solicitors, whatever you want to refer them to, legal advisors, to me as exactly that, advisors. Use them in the beginning and use them proactively, not reactively, right? What's your advice? You've got the floor. What's your advice to people listening here and saying, when do I engage a lawyer? Should I engage a lawyer? What's your message with so many years of experience?
I think the main thing is, if you're not sure, just ring us up and ask, because it's not going to cost you anything to say, Craig, do I need some advice now? And I'll tell you straight away whether you do or you don't. And look, you know,
pick up the phone.
Half of the time, someone will ring me up and I'll say, look, you actually don't have a problem, but that just lets you sleep better.
Yeah.
You know, you have a bit of peace of mind, so you can spend a bit more time in your business because you're not just thinking, oh, do I need to call a lawyer about this or that? And the times when you do need the help, you've gotten out in front of it and you're going to deal with it early, because the big bills we see is when people have sat on something for far too long and they haven't asked a question, and then they run into trouble, and then they come and see us when the problem is
reactive,
gargantuan.
Yeah, reactive exactly. Costs money. That's the message. Yeah. Get, you know, you heard there, the one thing that's amazing about a Hill House, and Craig's a very humble guy, he won't promote it, but I certainly will. Hill House do not treat you like a transaction, and most lawyers do, and that's not a crack at lawyers. It's just the system. They bill every 6 minutes and all the rest of it. The one thing I found with Hill House is that they don't treat you like a transaction, and you heard it there from Craig. If you're in doubt, pick up the phone, and he won't even charge you for that initial chat. You know, being part of the coffee commune, they're very generous with all of our community. They're generous in general. Pick up the phone, give them a call and say, hey, I've got a quick question for you. Of course, if it goes beyond that, everyone's got to be commercial, but I can't stress enough, be proactive. If you've got any sort of matter going on at the moment or question in your head that could require legal advice, then if you don't do anything else when listening to this, do one thing, pick up the phone and ring someone. The team at Hill House are happy to talk to you, but pick up the phone and get that advice early. Craig, any finishing comments? All good from your end?
All good, yeah. Thank you very much.
It's always a pleasure to have you. So much wisdom in that time, and we obviously try and keep these segments condensed down, noting that a lot of people are time poor, but some really, really key nuggets there. There'll be some key takeaways put up from our wonderful producer and owner of Podcast Boss, Mr. Gilberto Castillo. He always does a wonderful job, thank you, on summarizing these, because we've covered a lot of ground there, from what to do in selling a cafe, points around equity and franchising, and underlying risk is member, get comfortable with your worst case scenario. Craig, thank you again for being so generous with your time and your experience and your wisdom. And we'll have you on the show, no doubt, in the very near future. But I thank you personally.
Yeah, thanks for having me, Phil.
Listeners, you're listening to another episode of Been There and Done That. Craig Hong, Corporate and Commercial Director from Hill House Lawyers. Phil DiBella, Founder and Managing Director here at the Coffee Commune. Until we see you next time, accelerate your potential and be the best you can be. That's a wrap for today. Keep listening for more episodes of Been There and Done That. The Coffee Commune is here to help accelerate your potential. We want you to be better tomorrow than today. Until next time, you've been listening to Phil DiBella. I'm the Founder and Managing Director of The Coffee Commune, a place where the coffee community comes to collaborate.